ARK Raiders, a multiplayer extraction adventure video game set in a lethal yet vibrant future Earth. Play as a raider, where you will settle into a fractured underground settlement, hoping to build a new home and legacy for yourself. In order to thrive, you must return to the surface, where lethal ARK machines roam unchecked and the motives of other raiders are dangerously unclear. But if you are fearless enough, who knows what you might find? Pre-order now for PlayStation 5, Xbox Series XS, and PC. Available on October 30, rated T for Teen.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Barry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Barry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, I'm Josh Radner, and I am so excited to tell you about How We Made Your Mother, a rewatch podcast looking back at How I Met Your Mother. And I'm here with Craig Thomas, who co-created the show along with Carter Bays. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Josh. Somehow it has been 20 years since the show premiered. I'm going to check the math on that. 10 years since it went off the air, and we thought that made this a perfect time to look back, see what the hell we did, and why the show still seems to resonate with fans around the world today.
Follow and listen to How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.
158 pounds of fun to be accurate. 65 degrees right now, going up to 85 today. Then another cool front comes in. Highs of 79 tomorrow and Thursday. Then the lower 80s on Friday and Saturday. Chance for showers on Saturday and Sunday, though. And then we're in the mid to lower 70s throughout next Wednesday. So that's good as we approach Halloween. Andy Smith joins us now, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. How you doing, Andy?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm guessing a little bit cooler there.
We're going to have high in the mid-60s today. Sunny. The leaves are starting to fade, but there's still enough time for the leaf peepers to come up here and spend some money.
The leaf, what is it?
Leaf peepers.
Leaf peepers. I like it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this government shutdown here and what's going on with, if I guess you can recap it because we're into what day? 58, 39, 115, it's like deja vu all over again, right?
Is there something actually going on? That's the question. Mm. Other than the press, is this something that's really impacting Americans yet? I don't believe it is yet.
Well, along those lines, let's talk about what's going on in the House, because now Marjorie Taylor Greene saying, you know what, the House should be conducting business, and Mike Johnson has him in recess. Tell me what's going on politically there, or I guess... practically speaking, with the business the House can conduct or can't, and why Mike Johnson doesn't want to have him in session?
Boy, there's been a lot of speculation as to why, given that there's still speculation about the Epstein files and seating the new congressman from Arizona who hasn't been seated because she wants to release the Epstein files. So there's that floating around. But I think it's more a part of the larger Republican strategy to force Democrats' hands on either voting for the continuation bill. But I mean, frankly, we're getting into November, which is when they start to pass the regular order bills come about for the different agencies. Democrats this last week did not pass the military bill in the Senate, but getting back to the House. And so I think what the House is doing is just basically forcing the action into the Senate, but they're going to have to open up because the negotiations for those regular order bills have to take place as well. So that has to be going on, and that needs to get moving quickly. And I can see why Congressman Green is upset about that.
So Mike Johnson has these press conferences daily where he blames the Democrats. But what I'm thinking is, politically, if you want to do theater, not that politics is theater or anything.
No.
But if you wanted to do that, well, take me through the rules in the Senate with cloture, because if I'm the Republicans, I would have the Democrats go through the theater of a filibuster, and then I could say, or is that possible with the rules, where I could say, look, we want to get the government open. These people are filibustering to keep us from doing that. Can that happen with the rules or not?
Well, yeah, that's what's happening right now. The Republicans are claiming that the Democrats are blocking it from being open.
But I mean, go through the actual theater of the filibuster.
Oh, to go through the actual theater? That's just a curious question. I don't know how I don't know that. I'd have to think about that one. But
because you see what I'm saying politically, if I'm the Republicans and I really want to put the focus, I'm talking about politically here. You can believe whatever you want, but I'm just talking about the politics of this, and I want to put the blame on the Democrats. By God, I'm going to have them filibuster and read the whatever it is, read the congressional record, whatever they have to do to make it seem as though they are really being obstructionists. Would that make sense or not politically?
I don't think that the Republicans don't have enough votes to do that. Typically, you're going to do a filibuster when it's your last resort, meaning that you don't have the votes to stop something.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democrats right now do have the votes to stop that from moving through because of the cloture vote that it takes. I think that I don't think that they're up to that point yet where they're going to have to do more theatrics, imagine mm-hmm. more theatrics in the Senate. I think that you'll see as time goes on, and as people aren't really feeling it necessarily, and the Republicans have been smart by saying, well, we got this bill to keep the military going. We're going to mm-hmm. get these other bills all lined up to keep all this other spending going. It's the Democrats who are stopping it. It's really the Democrats who have the weaker hand here. First off, because they don't hold the presidency, and the president controls what spends, what stays open and what doesn't stay open. The executive branch can control that. But I think that the Republicans can just continue to point saying, hey, you guys aren't spending, you aren't spending. And if they start getting into those individual bills, it's easier to pick off those few Democrats that for whom those bills are their, you know, that's their area of expertise, or that's something that's very, very important to their state. And then you're likely to see some of those individual spending bills go through.
So you can go through whatever theatrics you want. Ultimately, it's the perception of the public, right? And how does the perception of the public stand now as far as this government shutdown? Is there blame to be laid, or do they even care at this point?
Yeah, it's slightly more against the Republicans, but I have it's so partisan because, like everything else, this is tied up in partisanship. Democrats blame the Republicans, Republicans blame the Democrats, and the people in the middle shrug their shoulders. I think that's pretty much where we are now because both sides have enough evidence to say we aren't losing this yet. And until somebody sees that they're going to be losing public support, I don't think we're going to see much movement. Most importantly, 2026 is coming around, and a lot of this is just angling and getting your party ready to go for the 2026 elections.
Getting them ready to go as far as the public is concerned, or getting them ready to go as far as firing them up like a pregame speech?
Firing them up. Absolutely. Firing them up. The Democratic Party has been in disarray since Trump got elected. They're looking for anything that can galvanize the party. They think that I think the leadership believes that stopping Republicans and Trump from passing this the spending bills is a way to galvanize their party support going into 2026. I think it's probably too early for that right now, but they really are in the Democratic Party is really in need of getting themselves in fighting trim for the election in the fall. The Republicans are pretty much good to go.
Yeah, I want to ask you how they got so disorganized. What happened to the Democratic Party? We'll talk about that when we come back. 621 traffic now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Andy Smith, our friend, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center, talking about the government shutdown. So they had these No King rallies, No Kings, whatever it was, rallies over the weekend. That shows what you're against, but does it show what people are for when it comes to the Democrats getting their act together or fielding candidates that have a chance of winning, et cetera? And how did the Democratic Party get in such a sense of disarray, Andy?
Well, I don't think that it does. Some wag wrote that it wasn't so much a protest, it was a collection of people with their NPR tote bags.
Yeah.
So it was kind of the usual suspects that were out there protesting over the weekend. So it's not really gotten down to the to be a protest where it's really people are angry. These are people that from people all along. But the Democratic Party and the position they're in, I think it's a long time coming, but it basically comes down to a couple things. First off, you can't govern against the will of the public for too long. And by taking unpopular positions on several issues and really sticking to them because of their smaller constituency groups, they've lost the blue collar vote. So people are concerned about economics, what's in their pocket. And if they see that the Democrats are more concerned about letting illegal immigrants into the country, I'm not saying this is true or not, but the impression is there, or supporting trans rights for kids in high school sports. These are things that the public looks at and says, well, what are you talking about? I'm worried about getting food on my table, and you're going to the floor on these sorts of issues. Ruben Gallego, who's a senator from Arizona, I heard him talk up here. He might be running for president, I heard him talk up here, and he was really making this case that the Democrats have lost the blue-collar vote, and it's been happening over a long period of time. It's not sudden, and they're now losing some of the minority vote. And that's real panic, because the Democratic Party under Obama basically set their goal as saying the country is going to be largely a majority-minority country. We've got all of these minority groups that are behind us, and they'll stay behind us, not thinking that Hispanics and Blacks and Asians and whoever are also, they're just more concerned about their economics than they are about their group identity.
So what can the Democrats do to improve their economic plight if, in fact, they are going to come back from wherever they are?
Well, I think what they have to do is something like Gallego and other people within the party are pushing, is to say, let's focus on the issues that the people are concerned about, not get lost in these kind of issues that are divisive, and we're taking a position that is just not the popular position. So they got to get back to economics. They got to get back to being the blue collar party. See, that's, I think, what their biggest problem is. It's kind of like schizophrenia. It's an elite party. It's an economic and social elite party based on the East Coast and the West Coast now. It's not the blue collar party that it once was, but they still think they are.
Is healthcare, are healthcare subsidies part of that blue collar thing that would resonate with people?
I think it would. And I think that's the area where you see Republicans are kind of nervous about this, because a lot of red state Republicans are concerned that those subsidies are going to a lot of their Republican voters. So that's an area where I think Democrats have some leverage. And I think that's one reason they're sticking to their guns right now in the Senate, is because they think that that's something that can hurt Republicans.
I go spray paint the leaves in your yard and attract some tourists and put the cup out. I know that's what you're all about this time of year. Thank you, Andy.
Great to talk to you.
Appreciate it. Pleasure as always. Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. We come back, we're going to talk to Leah Long, director of the Louisiana chapter of the Louisiana of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, about how small business owners are feeling about the economy, about tariffs, shutdown, and more. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 6:46, 14 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. 65 degrees, going up to about 85 today, then cooler tomorrow, highs near 80 for the next 3 days, a little bit of a chance for showers over the weekend, then it cools off again. So we're looking at highs as we approach Halloween in the mid-70s or so, no real cold front, but at least it's not 85 or 90 degrees, right? Leah Long joins us, director of the Louisiana chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, NFIB. Talk about small business owners and how they're feeling given the economic climate. Good morning, Leah. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
What does what do the surveys say about optimism and small business owners during the month of September, I guess, right?
So, yeah, for September, unfortunately, it was the first decline in 3 months. So the optimism index did fall 2 points. And, you know, small business owners are generally viewing their businesses kind of in healthy conditions, but they're still juggling rising costs, slower sales expectations, and they're continuing to have labor quality issues. I know we talk about that all the time on here. And so that, along with just kind of what's going on in D.C., they're kind of worried about what policies might affect their business and, you know, the health of their business moving forward, too.
What kind of policies are they concerned about?
Well, it's just different things, you know, government mandates that could eventually come down. You just kind of never know. And so I think we've kind of got past, we're still dealing with some facts of inflation, but just what goes on in D.C., obviously the administration does have effect on all the business owners. And so just kind of seeing how that plays out and different things going on, not even just in D.C., but also on the state level too. And, you know, we're gearing up toward 2026 session, and that's something that business owners are thinking about too, like what new policies are going to be made that affects their businesses.
Do you differentiate between the supply and the demand side, for example? What are the business owners saying when it comes to inventories, when it comes to somebody texted in and said they'd love to sell American shirts, but they can't when the stuff they get from overseas is so much cheaper. I don't know how tariffs have affected that or not. What are you hearing about tariffs?
So we haven't directly polled the business owners on tariffs, but, you know, it's definitely industry specific. But I will say in the latest release, it was saying the inventory levels have definitely declined over the last month, and that, you know, could be to tariffs, could be a lot of different things. But again, it's still pretty industry specific on how, you know, the tariffs affect your industry.
What are you hearing from business owners about their biggest concern besides the recession?
Yeah, so the biggest concern is still labor quality. We talk about that on here all the time, being able to find a qualified workforce and, you know, be able to have that skill set workforce to fill these jobs. The idea is to create as many jobs as possible in Louisiana, but you do have to have qualified workers to do that. And, you know, as we move forward through session and different opportunities to be able to engage, you know, the public sector and the school sector to be able to get people into different trade school programs and promote that. And, you know, you think about construction, transportation, manufacturing. Those are huge industries that we need the qualified workers for.
Where are the shortages when it comes to qualified workers?
And definitely in those industries, you know, construction, manufacturing, transportation. And so that's something you see that you use every day. You know, there's always some sort of contract worker needed, whether in your construction, manufacturing, plumbers, air conditioning. And a lot of those businesses are independent, independently owned. And so that is something to always remember when you are needing those type of workers.
Did you say contract workers?
Well, a lot of I like to say contract, you know, contract plumbers, contract AC people, contract construction workers. I always used to say that, you know, we love big companies coming in to Louisiana also, because a lot of those people that work in those big companies are, you know, do the product, do the initial building of the big companies. They are independently owned contractors.
So, wait, I'm confused. So that means the companies, they hire the workers as contract workers and don't provide benefits? Is that what you're saying, or am I conflating something?
No, I'm just saying if you're a small business owner, let's say you're a one man and a contractor, and you go get a contract job with a bigger company, you're a small, you're your own small business owner.
I got you.
So, yeah.
Okay. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:57, beautiful fall morning here, Tuesday, October 21st. Talking to Leah Long, Director of Louisiana Chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, NFIB. A new survey says optimism among small business owners nationwide fell in September. Leah, somebody texted and said, is this lady saying that the impact of the immigration crisis has a direct effect on construction, including plumbing, carpentry, roofing, framing, etc.?
We haven't polled exactly on the immigration issue on what's affecting that, but it does go back to obviously different things add and contribute to the workforce issues that they're having. And, you know, in those industries, it could be various things. So,
but there's a shortage of those kind of workers, right?
Yeah, there definitely is a shortage of those type of workers. And we've seen that long before, you know, the immigration issues began. That's been happening the last year or so. So that's definitely always been those three main things, construction, manufacturing, and transportation, always kind of have a shortage in workforce, skilled workforce people available.
What are you optimistic about, Leah?
So I'm optimistic that as we continue to move toward session in 2026, you know, we have some high hopes. As always, everyone goes into session as hopeful as, you know, as we can be. And so I would like to see a lot of changes done in the workers' comp arena. You know, a lot of reform. We talked about insurance reform last year, and I think we need to move toward workers' comp. You know, that we have the fifth highest premiums, I think, in the country when it comes to workers' comp, and we've got to find a transparent balance system, you know, to get the workers back to work and to also help the employers, you know, lower their costs too.
I don't know a lot about workers' comp, having never experienced any part of it. Tell me what the problems are.
you know, the problem is it is just a very expensive system. And, you know, you always have good actors and bad actors. And the ideal goal for the system is that, you know, you need to make sure that the worker gets the help that they need when they are hurt and injured on the job and get them back to work as soon as possible. But, you know, we kind of go back to the lawsuit climate of the state we live in. And so that plays into the factors of the workers' comp arena also.
Workers' comp is underwritten by whom?
The Workers' Comp Commission and then the Workforce Commission.
All right. Holiday spending thoughts? Think it's going to be good or what?
You know, we work well with the Workforce Commission and be able to, you know, kind of figure out different things with them and what's you know, most beneficial for the employer and the employee. And so I think that's, you know, Secretary Susan up there, Susie, she is very good at that. So we're continuing to work with her.
All right, thank you. Appreciate your time. Leah Long, Director of Louisiana Chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Glenn Gilbo, editor of Tiger Rag, about Brian Kelly, what he said after his press conference after the Vanderbilt game and ahead of the Texas A&M game and what happens from here. Plus, we'll talk about the outage at AWS. So a lot coming up. Stay with us. Tommy Tucker, WWL. 7:15, Tommy Tucker, beautiful fall morning. Temperatures in the mid-60s around the area, going up to the 80s. Then cools off a little bit tomorrow and through the rest of the week and into early next week, as a matter of fact. Glenn Gilbo joins us now, editor of Tiger Rag. I'm not sure that Brian Kelly's chair is getting any cooler. Good morning, Glenn. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. Tell me about Tiger Rag before we run out of time.
Well, Tiger Rag magazine's a daily website and a monthly magazine, been covering LSU since the late 1970s, not associated with LSU, independent, and that's been noticeable lately, I would say.
Tell me how it's been noticeable.
Well, we've been pretty critical of the football team and Brian Kelly, and you know, particularly after the Vanderbilt game. Todd Horn, our executive editor, has said, you know, he should be replaced. I've basically said that too. And it boils down to what he was expected to do here, because he was really hired to win a national championship at a national championship salary before he won the national championship, mm-hmm. You know, $100 million for 10 years. And he was expected to at least contend for that, and he really hasn't come close to the playoffs in his four seasons here.
I say this not to argue with you, but for explanation, Glenn. Tell me why this falls on Brian Kelly, in your opinion.
Well, he's the head coach, for one, and I think that's the main reason. But I also put a lot of blame on Scott Woodward, the athletic director, for hiring him to such a long-term contract. But, you know, it all falls on the head coach.
Is that a new thing in college football where maybe if you look at what's happened so far this season, where maybe long-term contract is a thing of the past, especially when you look at the changing situation in college football with NIL, transfer portal, all that stuff?
It should be a thing of the past. It needs to be, because there's such a financial burden on programs and the boosters and money people to pay for the roster now. You know, you can't also be paying the coach such long-term salary situations, I believe, because you have to pay that NIL roster and get players through the portal every year. It just makes more sense for a shorter term contract, especially with you know, coaches and schools not wanting to stick with a coach for a long time. You know, it ought to be closer to 5-year contracts, I would say.
You know, one thing that kind of surprised me about Brian Kelly is the way he said about the offensive line, when he said if we had somebody better, we'd be playing them. That kind of goes back on him. It just seemed like an odd thing to say. It would seem as though these are our guys and we're going to coach them up, or we're going to get the physicality that we need out of them, not if we had other guys, we'd be playing them. Did that strike you as odd or not?
Well, I think he's saying that's the best we got right now. I mean, he did.
But that's on him, right?
It is. But he did lose four starters from last year's offensive line that he built, and all four of those guys were drafted. So everyone knew going in that it was going to be a rebuilding year for the offensive line. But I think what that also says is that, you know, Brian Kelly, unlike the three coaches before him at LSU, he's not recruited greatly. Those Saban was a top five class every year. Les Miles and Ed Orgeron tend to be in the top 10, sometimes in the top five. He's not really a top 10 recruiter. He's more top 15, and just hasn't brought in that same kind of talent. And only this year did they bring in a highly ranked portal class. The school's partly to blame for that because they kind of got into the transfer portal late. But he's not recruited like Les Miles and Ed Orgeron. He's not close to those two.
Let's talk about Ed Orgeron, too. They're still paying him. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. And also about the record, the comparative record between Ed Orgeron and Brian Kelly when it comes to ranked opponents, because there's a big discrepancy there. 720, we're talking to Glenn Gilbo, editor of Tiger Rag. Another question, of course, is if you do get rid of Brian Kelly, who do you bring in? Who pays his salary? I don't think he's going to quit. He's 64 years old. 720, traffic now, WWO. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Glenn Gilbo, editor of Tiger Rag, talking about Brian Kelly and LSU and the situation they find themselves in. Brian Kelly's got a different record when it comes to ranked opponents than did Ed Orgeron. Ed Orgeron's still getting paid on his contract. Where's the money going to come from if they decide to part ways with Brian Kelly?
Well, actually, Orgeron's contract finally has been paid off. He had a large buyout, $18 million, that was finished, paid out. That was a kind of a ridiculous buyout for Scott Woodward to have in Coach Orgeron's contract, because he didn't want another job, and even after he won the national championship, there wasn't people trying to hire him, so mm-hmm. He wasn't in that situation. But you know, they're going to be paying off Brian Kelly for a long time. If he doesn't return after this season, it would be a $53 million buyout. So they're really tied to him. I don't know if they're going to want to do that because of financial reasons, because then you got to buy an entire, you know, new staff. And then you also now, you know, you got to pay for the next class through the portal. So they're kind of backed into a corner there. I don't think they're going to want to make that move this year.
If not him, who's out there?
Well, you know, there's always coaches out there. I would say Lane Kiffin is a hot name right now, but you know, I don't think LSU's got that far where they actually have any names yet, so I wouldn't know about that. But Scott Woodward, he's got a lot of experience hiring coaches. Unfortunately, his last two hires have not been great. Jimbo Fisher, he is still getting paid from his contract by Scott Woodward. And then Brian Kelly following that. He hasn't really hired a really good coach since he was at Washington in 2013 when he hired Chris Peterson.
So let's talk about LSU Texas A&M Saturday night. You like the Tigers' chances at all?
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't bet on this game, but it wouldn't shock me if LSU pulled an upset this week, you know, because they're at home. Texas A&M tends to falter right after they get going. You know, they're coming in.
ARK Raiders, a multiplayer extraction adventure video game set in a lethal yet vibrant future Earth. Play as a raider, where you will settle into a fractured underground settlement, hoping to build a new home and legacy for yourself. In order to thrive, you must return to the surface, where lethal ARK machines roam unchecked and the motives of other raiders are dangerously unclear. But if you are fearless enough, who knows what you might find? Pre-order now for PlayStation 5, Xbox Series XS, and PC. Available on October 30, rated T for Teen.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. TNCs apply. In-app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, I'm Josh Radner, and I am so excited to tell you about How We Made Your Mother, a rewatch podcast looking back at How I Met Your Mother. And I'm here with Craig Thomas, who co-created the show along with Carter Bays. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Josh. Somehow it has been 20 years since the show premiered. I'm going to check the math on that. 10 years since it went off the air, and we thought that made this a perfect time to look back, see what the hell we did, and why the show still seems to resonate with fans around the world today.
Follow and listen to How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.
Number three in the country, but they've never been able to finish. It would be just like the SEC for a flip game like this for LSU to win at home. But again, I wouldn't bet on it. You keep thinking LSU is going to flip the switch because they have the talent, you know, throughout the roster, particularly the skill positions, but they just haven't been able to do it. So, you know, I don't think they're going to be able to do it against one of the best teams in the country right now.
But that brings us back to offensive line and what's going to change, right?
Yeah, on the offensive line, they have gotten better with the run game, but then they got bad at pass blocking this past week. So that's been kind of the story of the season. They get one thing fixed, and then the next thing messes up. They, you know, the offense has played well in spots, but it doesn't play well when the defense is playing well. They've just been out of sync really all season, even in the games they've won against bad teams like South Carolina and Florida. You know, they scrape by with 20 to 10 wins, and the Ole Miss and the Vanderbilt loss, they played well in spots, but not through the game.
LSU has to win out to get in the playoffs?
They would have a chance with three losses, but you know if that was a good loss, but I don't think so, man. It's probably gonna they're probably gonna have to win out because you got so many SEC teams log jammed at about one or two losses. So they would probably have to win out, and that looks really difficult with three ranked teams coming up.
Yep. Thank you. Appreciate your time, Glenn Gilbo, editor of Tiger Rag. We'll take a break, talk about the AWS outage when we come out. When we come back, rather, it's 7:30, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. We all know, I think, by now what happened with Amazon and AWS yesterday, but as Carlos Perez joins us now, Director of Security Intelligence at TrustedSec joins us, I think a lot of people know Amazon from, hey, I want that. You order it and it shows up at your doorstep and they don't realize about AWS. So with that, we welcome in Carlos Perez. How you doing?
Doing good.
Tell me what happened yesterday and then we'll go from there.
Okay, so what happened was that AWS had a small glitch with their DNS service. So DNS is domain name service, which is the way that you put in www.amazon.com and that turns into an IP address so you can communicate. So it turns whatever name you have registered in a simple manner into the IP address for communications. And IP address is the way that most computers communicate in the internet. That system had a glitch. And that glitch, what caused was a cascading effect in multiple services as it relates to their data centers on the East Coast. Given that many industries out there have set up all of their services on that data center on the East Coast, and have set that data center and its services as dependencies, even if they are in other locations or across the globe, that cascading effect actually costs all of those services to be affected.
So this is kind of like the middleman that translates what you type to get you to where you're going?
Correct. You can think of it as a phone book. where you go into a phone book or your contact list and you have a name, and that name then turns into a phone number that you're able to then reach out to the person.
Is there any indication that anything nefarious happened here, or was it just, as you say, a glitch?
It was just a glitch. So what happened is that a lot of people, when they are setting up, in fact, let me bring it back. When we were talking about cloud services, a cloud service is where you're using somebody else's computer to save money. So in other words, Amazon has set up multiple data centers across the U.S. and the globe where you pay them money to use those systems and they administer those systems. In addition to that, they have ancillary services that they provide. So you don't have to manage and set up those services. They just go like, hey, here, use my Dynamo database service. So what happens is that a lot of people rely on that. A lot of businesses and companies rely on those services. And those services use that phone book or that contact list to be able to talk internally across each other. So what happens is that when that specific area failed, all of those other applications that depended on it in the background also failed. But what happens when you have multiple failures and you have a large amount of failures that you cannot manage, then you try to move that over into another data center or somewhere else. But given that that service is so critical and the workload is so large, when you design those failures, those transitions, you're expecting, oh no, I want to transition 50% of my workload. I want to transition 20% of my workload. But never 100%. So they never thought that they would have such a failure in the background of cascading effects where one thing led to another, that then the service trying to bring itself back up just made it worse.
I'm going to try not to injure myself here, Carlos, but was it hardware or software, or do they know?
Software.
Software.
All of it was the way that you can figure everything out.
Okay, so this was a design flaw that revealed itself?
This was a series of design flaws and bad practices. Many times when we configure all of our different services, we look for single points of failure. So I'm going to spread my workload, in the U.S., between the East Coast and the West Coast. Mm-hmm. What happened is that a lot of these companies, when they set up all of their stuff, they went like, you know what, to save money, I'm just going to keep it inside of the East Coast region, and I'm just going to do all of my load balancing or just all of my redundancy across that region, because I would never expect Amazon to have a full region fail. So it was a series of bad assumptions with bad design.
By the app operator, not AWS?
By both. Oh. In the case of AWS, they never thought that DNS would be such a critical point. And then by the app designers that were designing all of this, they thought, wait, I never think Amazon is going to have this type of large failure, so I'm just going to keep most of my eggs in this same basket.
Okay, let me take a break. I'm going to let my eyes deglaze. We're talking to Carlos Perez, Director of Security Intelligence at TrustedSec, about the AWS outage yesterday, 7:51, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:58, couple of minutes left with Carlos Perez, Director of Security Intelligence at TrustedSec, talking about the AWS outage yesterday. Who primarily was affected, Carlos?
So we have multiple financial organizations, both in Europe and the U.S., that were affected. Among them, for example, Coinbase. We had Slack. We had Snapchat. And we have many others that were also affected that run their services in AWS.
So is this money that was lost forever, or is it just a pause and then business resumes as normal?
It is just a pause and then business resumes, but the money that you were not able to earn during the period with your customers is something that you may incur some losses, as customers may not come back or there may be issues where you need to refund a customer because of services were not provided.
So what did WHO learn from this, and how do they prevent it from happening again?
So Amazon learned that their DNS service needs to be improved, as well as their backend services, to be able to handle this type of outage and to make it more resilient. And customers learn that they need to improve the way that they set up all of their applications and their backends, so they're more resilient and spread that load, not only across multiple Amazon data centers, but also look at other services like the ones provided from Microsoft and Google. Right now, the biggest problems we have is that when it comes to cloud computing and cloud services, we only have three major players that most of the industry uses.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Carlos Perez, Director of Security Intelligence at TrustedSec. Hope that helped you understand what went on and what hopefully will not happen again. Bruce Shenelson joins us as we come back. We'll talk about the Middle East peace agreement and what's going on there, what could derail it. Then we'll talk to Jeff Nowak about the Saints. A lot coming up. Stay with us. 8:15 now, beautiful morning in the Crescent City, and it's going to be a little bit warmer today than it was yesterday, but then it cools off tomorrow and the next day, and we should be near 80 for the next week or so with a chance for showers over the weekend. Bruce Shenelson joins us now, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University, previously worked in the State Department and on the Middle East peace process. He knows the players involved. He's been in the rooms where the conversations have been held, and we appreciate his time when it comes to talking about things in the Middle East. Good morning, Bruce. How you doing?
I'm doing okay, Tommy. Hope you are as well.
I am, sir. Let's talk about, first of all, I saw the interview on 60 Minutes with, I guess it was Scott Kushner and Welkner. What's his name? I don't have it in front of me right now.
Yeah, Steve Witkoff and then
Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner.
Yeah.
Yes. How tough was it to put that together, the fragile peace that they have established, and then we'll talk from there about what happened on Sunday or yesterday?
Yeah, it was tough, and I'll say President Trump definitely deserves credit, in part because he was really the only person that could pressure Prime Minister Netanyahu. Every time a Democrat tried to do it, you know, the Republicans would support Netanyahu, and President Trump did it, and we've had, you know, important things achieved already, right? These hostages are home. Some of the remains have been recovered and returned, some not yet. Some 2,000 Palestinian prisoners were released and sent back to their homes, and humanitarian aid has started to flow in. All those things are important, and they've had real benefits for real people, but the rest of it, you know, is gotten, you know, more complicated and a little dicey.
And also, to his credit, you know, I saw him on Air Force One saying that, and this goes to, you know, when we talk about these things in the Middle East, if you're going to go to war with ideology, who do you go to war with? Well, when if you're going to negotiate peace with an ideology, who do you negotiate with? And then who can break that peace? And that's what we're talking about here that may have happened over the weekend, right?
That's right, on both sides. You know what happens when you have a ceasefire? It does two things. One, it stops the immediate killing, and it buys you time to kind of deal with the other issues. And what it really requires is that both parties that sign the ceasefire, in this case Hamas and the Israeli government, kind of really want it to make it work, and they don't look for excuses to say, oh, the other guy broke it, I'm going to break it now. And we're seeing a little bit, sadly, of that happening. You know, I mean, the notion that there had been, you know, and what apparently wasn't even Hamas, it was some other, you know, element, radical element in Gaza firing on Israelis, and the Israelis immediately said, we're going to cut off the humanitarian aid. Fortunately, the United States said, no, you can do other things, but not that. So I'm not convinced that I think the sides are more interested in avoiding the blame right now than keeping moving on this. And if we don't keep moving, the whole thing falls apart.
Wait, say that part again, Bruce, about both sides are more interested in what?
Both sides, I think, are more interested in not being blamed for it failing, mm-hmm. right? You know, they kind of had to be dragged to the table. And by the way, it wasn't, you know, it's like in sports, when the quarterback has a good game and he thanks the rest of the team. This wasn't just Trump. We worked with Turkey and Qatar and you know, and Egypt on this. And they put pressure on Hamas the way we put it on Israel. And then neither side wanted to be the one blocking it, so they said yes. But now you can see a little bit of, you know, hey, you know, if the other guy breaks it, I'm going to break it too, rather than, can't we work this out? Can't we figure out a way to keep going and make sure that, you know, there aren't violations on both sides? I'm not convinced there's enough commitment to keep going.
So at some point, though, the United States did tell Israel, okay, stop, enough, you resume the humanitarian aid, and that kind of kept the agreement going or not?
Yeah, and then there have been, you know, incidents like you were talking about in the last 10 days since it was signed, and we've kept some pressure on it. And President Trump sent, you know, Kushner and Witkoff back to Israel, and apparently Vice President Vance, too. But, you know, there's so many components of this, and, you know, a big victory was declared, you know, far beyond what was reached. You know, it says there's going to be a so-called international stabilization force, you know, what we often call a peacekeeping force. You know, but the countries haven't committed to that, and they're not going to commit to put their troops on the ground, whether they're Egypt or Saudi or the Emirates, until they feel that the Israelis are not going to attack them and Hamas is not going to attack them. And so the amount of work that needs to be done is much more than, here's where I think the president went way overboard. I mean, claiming this is like the greatest thing in the Middle East since Moses split the Red Sea, you know, and you got to achieve that. You can't just declare it and then, you know, leave the loose ends to break up.
One thing that did interest me is, and this goes to, you know, I don't want to get you in a political vortex here or anything, Bruce, but you got to watch what political corner you back yourself into, because sometimes the people you back yourself into the corner with sometimes leave you there, in that Jared Kushner said that a lot of the Palestinians had nothing to do with Hamas and they were just victims, and he talked about how destroyed Gaza was.
That's absolutely right. I mean, before the war, say September 2023, you know, a reputable Arab polling agency did some polling in Gaza. And 62% of the Palestinians in Gaza were anti-Hamas because it wasn't providing jobs, it wasn't taking care of their kids, and it wasn't providing health care, right? And then, of course, they became even more anti-Israel because of what the war has done to them. But they also blame Hamas for putting them in this position. And so you need to find a way, you know, to not alienate those people by more attacks and work with them and some other Palestinians, what was called the Palestinian Authority over in the West Bank, you know, to bring some governance that's an alternative to Hamas and that's not an Israeli occupation or this notion of a board of peace that the British and the Americans run. They don't want that. They want something that they feel that they've got a stake in and that has some credibility with their own people.
One thing I did see was the CBS correspondent talk about the relationship between Kushner and Witkoff and knowing some of the players involved, but in a way, she seemed to imply that there was something wrong there, something untoward there. But I talked about you being in the room. When you talk about something, even on this scale, ultimately it does become about relationships, right?
It does. And look, there is a lot of money being made on the side here. There's no question about it, by the Trump Organization and by others. Okay, that's there, and that shouldn't be. Kushner worked in the first Trump term on what they called the Abraham Accords, which was Israel with some of the surrounding countries like Morocco and the United Arab Emirates, you know, agreeing to normalize relations, not with the Palestinians. So he did establish relationships. But every time there's been a peace agreement that's endured, I mean, look at the Camp David Accord that Jimmy Carter did 50 years ago with Egypt and Israel. It still exists, despite everything else. You know, I mean, who would have predicted that it would withstand all this stuff? That takes rolling up your sleeves, not just flying in and flying out, you know, committing to working out the details. And we're not seeing that level of diplomacy coming from, you know, from Witkoff and Kushner. And they need a backup team of people who also have relationships, have been around the block more than them. And frankly, it's been more to kind of, you know, do the press conferences, win the news cycle, claim victory, and then, you know, say that it fell apart because of the other guys. And so I'd love to see parts two and three here, not just part one, which
so,
went okay.
But they did get the hostages back, right? So what happens now, and how fragile is this, and what do you think is likely to happen? It seems to me Israel crossed the bridge too far when they went in a cutter, and that's when the president got involved and stood up to Netanyahu and said, no, we can't, you know, we got to do something here. And that's how that led to the hostages coming back. And again, Bruce, you know far about, you've forgotten more about this than I'll ever know. But I'm just wondering what needs to be done from this point forward. And I think that's what you just alluded to make sure that we do have some kind of lasting peace here, and that in some way Gaza begin. I don't know who's going to rebuild Gaza, where that money's going to come from, but it's hard to find anything standing there, isn't it?
Yeah, I know it's been destroyed. Frankly, with oil countries in the region, you know, money's not a total problem, right? The Saudis, that would be the role of the Saudis and the Emiratis and all these others that make a lot of money on oil. Netanyahu has, you know, parts of his own government that still think they want to make Gaza part of Israel and build fancy resorts and all that sort of thing. And so, you know, they're kind of pushing in their government the same way some people in among Hamas are pushing for this thing to fail. And that's where you need, you know, the people that signed the agreement to say, I am committed to making it work, and I'm going to work really hard to make it work. And I'm not seeing that either from the Netanyahu or from Hamas. And, you know, that's the time you buy with a ceasefire, you got to use. Otherwise, you know, the clock runs out and things fall apart.
So what if you were looking at dominoes and you were looking for the first domino to fall that would completely disrupt this fragile ceasefire? What would it be? Or has it already happened?
It hasn't happened yet. You know, it's been contained. It'd be more attacks. And I think if the Israelis start to, in a retaliation for whatever Hamas does, cut off the humanitarian aid. Look, I have a colleague here at Duke who's a doctor and who went into Gaza and actually created a children's village this summer, getting food to them, medical care. I mean, amazing and brave work that he's done in a humanitarian way. And I've been, you know, talking to him lately, and he's hoping that this will provide more opportunity for aid to come in. On the Israeli side, if they start to squeeze the aid, you know, there are other things they can do to retaliate if Hamas breaks it. On the Palestinian side, you've got to bring in the Palestinians, you know, who want to work for the betterment of their people, not to fight a revolution. And those two things need to really move and move quickly.
Thank you, Bruce. Here, the orchestra, we got to go. I appreciate your time. Bruce Jennelson, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University. 826, quickly to traffic on WWL. 8:46, 14 till 9, Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter, joins us now. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing good. How about yourself, Bobby?
Tommy. I'm complimented that you would call me the Cajun Cannon. I've heard a lot of sideline reports. I've never heard one about the blue injury tent blowing away.
Yeah, no, that was kind of wild. It happened a few times. Like, it was when Kendre Miller was in there initially. And they actually had, at points, they had to have staffers kind of standing on the corners of the tent. I don't know if it wasn't staked down properly And that's why, you know, I brought that up mainly because, you know, when Blake Griffey missed that 53-yard field goal, I don't know how much this comes through on TV, but he went out there and I was like, he's not making this. Because you watch.
It doesn't come through on TV. I didn't listen to TV, but as far as the video, it doesn't come through at all. That's why I turned down the sound and turn up you guys. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, and it's tough to kind of gauge because, you know, you're standing down there at field level, and there's some of these stadiums where the wind not only comes in, but it kind of swirls.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the issue they were having with the tent, was like it kept blowing away from different directions.
Wait, so Blake Griffey comes in, and you said what?
Well, I mean, like when he went out there to attempt a 53-yard field goal, I was like, this is a mistake. I don't think anyone's making a 50-plus-yard field goal when the wind's blowing like this, especially because it wasn't a consistent wind. It was kind of gusting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you'd almost prefer when you have a standing like 20-mile-an-hour wind because you can just at least play it.
With golf, at least, right, same kind of thing.
Trying to play the wind, and then the wind didn't gust, and it just stayed right where it was, you know? And so that's – but, yeah, it was the conditions were nasty to start that game. I think that played into why the offense was had such a hard time to begin the game, and it did clear up as the game went on, and I think that also played into why they seemed to have a little bit more success as the game went on. But yeah, it was definitely not a comfortable day down there, to say the least.
Let's talk about the injuries.
Yeah, Eric McCoy, Kendre Miller, both done for the year, and I wasn't necessarily surprised by it. Like a lot of times when you see these guys come out of the tent, you can kind of read on their faces, you know, how significant they think the injuries are, and you know, both those guys, you could tell, you know, they were just looking up, they were just disgusted by, you know, what they were experiencing, Eric McCoy, I believe his injury is a torn biceps, which that'll end his season. Kendre Miller, torn ACL, that'll end his season. And you just hate it for both those guys because they dealt with injuries last year. Kendre Miller has obviously been a well-documented story. His career's kind of been snake bit by injuries. He just worked so hard this year, and he finally had a long run of help to start the season. Torn ACL, it's it's just bad luck more than anything else.
You can't question anybody's toughness. You can't question this or that. The other thing is just, it sucks. It just sucks. Right. But it's a torn ACL. What are you going to do, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's the third year in a row. He's going to be limited. I think his career, he had 8 games his rookie season, 7 games last, or 6 games last season, 7 games this season. So, I mean, that's just, he's a half season player at this point. You know, he's still under contract. He'll be back next year, but you just don't know where you're going to be at that point. You don't know where he's going to be at that point. We'll see what, you know, it's going to be an opportunity for Devin Neal to step up and the rookie to get a much bigger run. You know, I talked to Alvin Kamara after the game, and he's like, man, it's like one of the smartest players I've ever been around. He understands what he's doing. He's just, you know, he's a rookie, but you don't worry about putting him in there because you know he can handle the assignments. He's been good in pass protection, which is going to be important for him. That's something he, you know, the coaches applauded him for during camp. And as a rookie player, that's one of the bigger questions you have to answer before they feel comfortable putting you out there. Like, are you going to get our quarterback killed? If we put you out there, they send a blitz and you don't know what you're looking at. He's been very good in that part of the game. And we'll see what he has. He only got one carry in that game. He did handle kick returns because Kendre had been one of your kick returners. But I'm sure we'll see a much bigger. I don't know if it's going to be the, you know, they were trying to make it kind of a legitimate tandem with Kendre and Alvin. And you had kind of seen their carries kind of split very evenly over the last several games. I don't know if that's what, if you're going to try to tilt it a little bit more toward Alvin as you kind of figure out what you have in Devin. But I know they're excited about Devin. They were very excited to bring him in. As far as Eric, they have a couple options in terms of what they could do. Mm-hmm. I expect they'll keep it the simplest. Like when you talk about shuffling an offensive line, teams will generally err on the side of the fewest moving parts. So I expect their plan will be to just start Luke Fortner at center. He's the guy they traded for late in the preseason. They sent Colin Saunders to Jacksonville and brought in Luke Fortner because they needed center depth. Will Clapp, who they had signed to be their backup center, he got hurt in the preseason. So Luke, that was his first kind of extended run yesterday, or Sunday, I should say, and they'll see more from him. They could also go with Torricelli Simpkins. He played center in the preseason, but you know, he's primarily worked at guard. He's also a UDFA. That would be a big responsibility for him. And then Cesar Ruiz, obviously played guard in college. Played center in college. He's been a guard in the NFL. He hasn't really, it seems like over the last few years, they haven't really viewed him as a center option. He's kind of been the guard with maybe a last resort center possibility. So they could theoretically put Cesar at center and have Simpkins or Radins play at guard. But again, that would be putting two players out of position, or that would be putting a backup at guard and another player out of position, as opposed to keeping four of your starters in place and only having one backup. That's what I would expect.
Seems like you break it once. It would make more sense just to break it once, right? Not move all these different pieces around. What did Kellen Moore have to say about the quarterback situation?
Yeah, you know, it's going to be a conversation that's had a lot outside of the building. You know, it's when you're a 1-6 team and you have a rookie quarterback sitting there, that's going to be a topic of conversation. We're going to talk about it. You know, the news is going to talk about it. It doesn't sound like they're considering making a quarterback change right now. You know, this was Spencer Rattler's first real kind of blow up game where you look at it and say, you probably didn't handle it that well. The turnovers were a problem, and they were kind of rough interceptions, right? Like one of them was left behind Mason Tipton. The other one, it looked like maybe a miscommunication with Shaheed, kind of overthrew it. And the last one was a fourth down, which kind of had to make a play. But, you know, the way they're looking at it is the Bears forced a ton of turnovers. It's on Spencer to come back and like build from that. And so, you know, he did say it's week to week. It's the first time we've heard that from him. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that they're a little bit closer than they have been. I don't think this was ever the week that you were going to try to go to a rookie. The week 12 against the Falcons always made the most sense to me. Coming off the bye, you have 2 weeks to kind of install. But we'll have to see. And you know, one thing about this team that I think has become clear is they're, I don't know if they're a very good road team. You know, you look at what's happened. When have their bad games come? When have their truly bad games come? It's been on the road. They played well at home. So I expect them to come back this week and bounce back in whatever fashion that looks like against the Bucs.
It makes sense to me after the bye as well. I know I was talking to Mike about this yesterday. It's a little bit late in the season, but you still have 7 games left to see what Tyler Shough can do. At some point, you're going to have to play him, don't you think, Jeff?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that by that point in the season, just based on how this has gone, the pressure would be off a little bit in the sense that, you know, you don't want the rookie to go in and then he's the one who blows the season and suddenly it's like, well, he didn't really have a chance anyway. But now, I mean, that would just make the most sense to me. I don't think I know Bobby after the game was talking about week 9 in Carolina, and that's still a potential option. Mm-hmm. I just think if you waited this long to get him in there, which you have to credit them for the patience. Not a lot of teams would be this patient in terms of letting it play out with Rattler the way they have. But I don't think you wait this long and then say your first start's going to be on the road. You know, I just don't think that makes sense.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it also, to me, shows that the Saints are playing a long game when it comes to this quarterback situation and not trying to win week to week. That sounds awful to say that, and I don't mean it to sound awful, but at this point, really, you got to start thinking about what's going to put you in the best position to win next year, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's how you look at it inside the, you know.
You can't. No, you can't. And, you can't go into the game saying,
right,
we're so just going to evaluate players. I understand that, but I'm just saying.
That's kind of the delicate balance you strike, but at a certain point, it has to be, we can't get to the end of a lost season and not know what we have in the rookie quarterback.
Exactly.
I think it's a lot more about that than it is about Spencer.
And other positions as well. That's right. That's exactly right. Not about Spencer. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it as always. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. He'll be on the sideline when the Saints take on Tampa Bay. 3 o'clock kickoff. All the action here on WWL. 8:55, 5 till 9. Traffic now on WWL. Thank you, Ian. 909. We're joined now by Lewis Fitzmaurice, St. Tammany Parish Assessor. Pick up our conversation that we had a while back about homestead exemption and increases or decreases. How you doing, Lewis?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How are you?
Give us a little recap, if you will, please, and then we'll take it from there.
Yeah, the last time we spoke, we were talking about the homestead exemption and about how many years. It's been about 45 years since the last time it was increased. Currently, it's at $75,000. And I believe when we spoke, the session had just finished up and stuff, and a bill had come up and got out of the House and Ways Committee, out of the House, to increase the homestead. That was to $125,000, so a $50,000 increase. And
ARK Raiders, a multiplayer extraction adventure video game set in a lethal yet vibrant future Earth. Play as a raider, where you will settle into a fractured underground settlement, hoping to build a new home and legacy for yourself. In order to thrive, you must return to the surface, where lethal ARK machines roam unchecked and the motives of other raiders are dangerously unclear. But if you are fearless enough, who knows what you might find? Pre-order now for PlayStation 5, Xbox Series XS, and PC. Available on October 30, rated T for Teen.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, I'm Josh Radner, and I am so excited to tell you about How We Made Your Mother, a rewatch podcast looking back at How I Met Your Mother. And I'm here with Craig Thomas, who co-created the show along with Carter Bays. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Josh. Somehow it has been 20 years since the show premiered. I'm going to check the math on that. 10 years since it went off the air, and we thought that made this a perfect time to look back, see what the hell we did, and why the show still seems to resonate with fans around the world today.
Follow and listen to How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.
It failed on the House floor. So we're looking, hopefully, that this session coming up, we're going to be able to maybe get another bill in there. But we're looking at about $100,000 now to increase it $25,000. And there's some reasons behind that.
Tell me about him, Lewis.
Okay. You know, we also discussed, Tommy, that, you know, there's 64 parishes and we're not all the same. And where we're really experiencing the issues of high residential values, probably the best way is along that I-10, I-12 corridor. All those areas are seeing some growth and increase in values. But here in St. Tammany and in Orleans, because I've been working with Assessor Williams in Orleans Parish on this, is that our high residential values, especially in this last reassessment that came up, and the issue that we have here in St. Tammany, lesser extent they have in Orleans, but 70% of all of the property taxes paid in St. Tammany Parish are paid by residential property owners. And leaving only 30 where the business. So to me, the increase in the homestead will help our residential try and get that burden shifted just a little bit, not a lot of bit, but it will be helpful. But there's a lot of parishes out there that you know, 125,000 homestead, it could really hurt them financially. So we feel like this 100,000, there's a good consensus that's a good figure. That could be all throughout the state. And so that's what we're going to work on this coming year, next year's session.
Because inflation has driven up in certain areas the price of the house, but the appraisal has gone up, but the exemption has not, right?
No. Like I said, in 45 years, it stayed the same in 45 years. And you're absolutely correct there, Tommy, that the homestead, even with it's a consensus out there, the homestead is probably the best vehicle to use to adjust and deal with the inflation. Like I said, inflation is a tax increase without a vote of the people, whether it's in property taxes, the increased value of property, or sales tax. So when that goes up, you know, you're paying more taxes. When those values go up, you're paying more taxes. This is a way to adjust for that. And it'll be helpful. It'll be really helpful.
Is there the political support for that?
We're hoping. We are so hoping. That's, you know, to me, you know, something is better than nothing. Here in St. Tammany, I would really like to see it at double to 150. Mm-hmm. But that would be a big hit on us here, too. That would be difficult. I think a reasonable compromise is that $100,000 to increase it by $25,000. That would save, at least here in St. Tammany, most taxpayers between $300 and $400 a year. And for those first-time home builders, for those with high income, that it doesn't sound like a lot, but it can make a difference between owning a home and not owning a home.
The other side of it, those that would oppose that would say, okay, the municipal governments, that's where the tax goes, right, are going to be looking at a shortfall or not? Am I missing something?
Well, no, that's legitimate. And everything's, timing's everything, as you know, Tom. And so we feel here in St. Tammany Parish, particularly just the 25,000, we can absorb that. We could adjust to it in our next reassessment year.
Tell me about the other parishes. What are you hearing from other assessors? Are you just dealing with Orleans Parish or all across the state?
I've talked to some others, and I've talked to some in the more rural areas, and there was some concerns. There was real concerns that if it went to $125,000, it could hurt. There was, in the last bill, there was a local option. But there's sort of a feeling that if this came before all the parish councils and bodies, that they would vote for it and put them just politically because of that. They would vote for it and put them in a situation where 100,000 without an option, where it would benefit every parish, every residential property owner in the state that's eligible for a homestead. We feel like that's the best direction to go. And that's the consensus I've been picking up.
How do you balance it out between parish, because the exemption 100,000 in Orleans Parish or Jefferson is not, or St. Tammany even, is not the same as 100,000 in Natchitoches or Rapides or wherever, right?
No, you're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. But I think there's a feeling, especially since it's been so long, and especially since we like to compare ourselves to Texas so much, that's what the state of Texas homestead is, 100,000.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you're absolutely right. We have higher values here. the lower values in some of those other and the more rural parishes and up north. So that would increase probably the number that they do have fully homestead. Like here in St. Tammany, only 5% of my residential property owners are fully homestead exempted. And the vast majority of that 5% are those who've had the senior freeze for a while. So it's frozen their values mm-hmm. over time. So like this last reassessment, that their values weren't touched at all. And those that live in like modular mobile homes out in the country. And even those, it's amazing what the mobile homes are going for now. It's mm-hmm. just, it's crazy. It really is. And this is a way to adjust. This is a way. And like that old saying goes, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. And this is just a bite at it. And hopefully this is something we can get past.
A text popped
up
optimistic. About the senior freeze. What is the senior freeze?
Senior freeze, when you turn 65, if your income, and if you're married, it's combined income, is $100,000 or less, you can freeze the value of your property. And that's statewide.
The assessed value.
That's statewide. The assessed yeah. value. So the point being, and how important that is come reassessment, when generally speaking, at least here in St. Tammany, values go up, yours won't. Now, I tell people it doesn't freeze your taxes. It freezes the value of your property. But which in another instance, most of everybody that was frozen before the 2024 reassessment, because of the rollback in the mills, they actually saw their taxes go down because the mills are less. Matter of fact, the mills are the lowest in St. Tammany they've been in 40, 45 years. Yet people still paying a lot of taxes.
Mm-hmm.
The reason being, the homestead hasn't increased to adjust for it.
The exemption has not increased.
Exactly.
Right. The price of the home has gone up.
Tremendously. Right. I like to tell this story. My wife, Tanya, and I bought our first home in Abita Springs in the early 90s. I want to say it was like 92. Little three-bedroom home. It was, you know, about 1,500 square feet. We paid $48,500 for it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Needless to say, we were fully homestead exempted. In 2020, that same house sold for $200,000. It's just, that's what's happening, particularly here in St. Tammany Parish. And it's been going on. Really, we've seen the increase in values after Katrina, when we had all the growth after mm-hmm. Katrina.
So I guess the only thing I'm thinking politically, I could see where legislators would say, yeah, I'm all for this. Absolutely. Let's increase the homestead exemption. But they would get pushback from local governments, for example, where you're talking about areas that would be, if
absolutely.
They become 100%
yes.
exempt, then all of a sudden there's yes. nothing going in. Then what happens?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And so that's why we feel the $100,000 is a reasonable amount. And the increase of just $25,000, that should not put anybody in a bad situation.
That's not going to hurt the smaller governments more than the bigger ones?
Well, I honestly don't know, Tommy, as far as everybody's individual parish's mm-hmm. situation. But that would be...
What are you hearing from municipal governments?
Well, I don't hear a lot from municipal because the homestead exemption doesn't matter for municipal governments.
Where's the money go?
In New Orleans, but here in St. Tammany with all our towns and cities, the homestead exemption doesn't apply to their taxes.
So it goes to parish governments?
It's just the parish. And
so what are you hearing from parishes is what I should have asked you.
Yes, yes, because... And then, like I said, it just depends on their situation. But here in St. Tammany, I'll give you an example. I've got a little over 7,000 that are fully exempt here. Like I said, it's about 5%. If we increase the homestead to 100,000, it's going to add about 1,800 to that number that are fully exempted. But let's say we went to 150,000 proposed. Then I would have over 20,000 who are fully homestead exempted. So almost $13,000 increase in the homestead. Mm. So you can see that that 25,000 helps, but it's not a big hit.
And somebody
in comparison to others.
Somebody wants to know about increasing the senior freeze, since people are upping that, since the income requirement on that, because people, they say, according to text line, I'm getting a couple of texts here, people are working longer, still at full salary, which increases their Social Security benefits as well on a sidebar.
Right.
But is there any appetite for that, or anybody looking at
it
any of that?
It seems like there was legislation that increased the, but it seems like there might have been something that came up that increased the senior freeze from 100 to maybe 150,000.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like, I don't know if that got out, or if that's something that would be another constitutional amendment, if that's the case, that we would have to vote on. But I've always been one of those. My preference would be with the senior freeze is to increase the age on it and have no income level on it.
What, 67, 70?
70, and then have no income requirements. But you are right. It used to be, I forgot what it was. It was around 75,000. Okay, so there is going to be something, I believe, on the ballot in March to increase the income level for the homestead. I mean, not the homestead, but the senior freeze.
Yes.
Complicated
stuff in the detail. It's in the weeds, but it's all about the numbers, and it ultimately affects our pocketbooks. That's why we wanted to have you back on. Thank you, Lewis. We appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for wanting the public to know what's going on. I really appreciate it.
It's important. It is. Thank you, sir, because you can't. It's on both sides. It's on what's going in and what service is going to be provided, and it's what's coming out of people's pocketbooks.
When it's all said and done, you get what you pay for.
That's exactly right. Lewis Fitzmaurice, thank you, sir. St. Tammany Parish Assessor. We'll take a break, talk to Dr. Judy Ho when we come back about what's the right age for kids to start doing stuff on their own. Not just trick-or-treating or staying home, but if you have adult kids, at what point do you back off and say, okay, it's your decision. You're married. I'm going to stay out of it. We'll be back. WWL. 9:29 on this Tuesday morning, beautiful Tuesday morning. Dr. Judy Ho joins us, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. We talk about mental health and about child raising issues and a lot of other different things. Morning, Dr. Judy. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I am outstanding. Thank you very much. And how's Luca and everybody over there in the Ho household?
Everybody is doing great. Luca's turning 4 in 2 weeks, so kind of crazy. Time is really speeding by.
Big party planned?
No big party. We're going to go on a little vacation, celebrate his 4th birthday. We asked him, vacation or party, and he said vacation. I was like, I agree.
Good for y'all. Outstanding. The money I spent on birthday parties, I could have gone to Lord only knows where I could have gone. Let's talk about...
Right?
Balance with kids and trick-or-treating and letting them be on their own, because you don't want to be a helicopter parent. You don't want to be a free range. You want to be, I guess, somewhere in between. I've done some research. It looks like the optimum age people say to go trick-or-treating alone is 12. I don't know. Let's talk about child raising and age appropriateness and all that stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a specific age, really. It's also, obviously, every child is different and, you know, how mature they are, et cetera. I would say, though, that in general, I don't know, when I was a kid, like, everybody just kind of let their kids wander the neighborhood, right? It kind of felt a little bit looser back then. Now I feel like maybe it's just parents are paying more attention, or maybe there's also an uptick in, you know, true problems that you have to be watching out for. I mean, most people that I see, especially with elementary school children, I mean, obviously they just take them trick-or-treating, right? They go with them, but they might do certain things to let them feel independent, like they'll stand at the driveway and let the kids go up themselves and kind of have that interaction be theirs. So I think there's a lot of different ways to slowly increase independence while also staying safe. I know that also some parents will say, okay, you can stay on this street and this street where we know the neighbors, but you can't go any other street. And if you feel like your child is old enough to know that and follow directions and you feel safe about that, But I think it's also about the parents' own comfort level. I also know parents who just never let their kids go trick-or-treating and wander off on their own, and their kids are teenagers and in high school.
Yeah, I want to open the text line here at 504-260-1870. Somebody texted in and said Dr. Judy just nailed it, which is, are the problems that we worry about now goblins, or are they real as it relates to kids wandering the neighborhood by themselves, et cetera?
Right, exactly. And I think that that's tough, you know, because you just don't 100% know what might happen. And I think that there's a little bit of a fear. There's more of a fear, too. And especially because of what we see in the news, media in general. So we're paying more attention. And you obviously want this to be a happy and safe holiday for everyone. So if you know that you're just a parent who you just don't feel comfortable for whatever reason, it's okay to honor that. But you also have to know that as your kid gets older, they might want a little bit of independence. So think about ways that you feel safe for them to do something that, you know, is a little bit out of your comfort zone, but you still feel like ultimately they're going to be taken care of, right? So it might be, okay, go to this Halloween event where at least it's enclosed. You can go with your friends, that's fine, but don't leave the premises. I'll drop you off and I'll pick you up. But have fun, right? Because there's lots of like haunted hay house rides and like haunted houses. And, you know, you can do something like that where they are free, but it's kind of within some type of enclosure and some type of rules and supervision that sort of governs the way that that place is run.
Somebody texted in, I don't know if there's any clinical research on this or not, but about, as we talk about Halloween, about scary movies and letting kids watch or opening them to the power of suggestion, or does it matter? I like, Dr. Judy, the movies from the 50s, the black and white horror movies that look as though it were done by a film student, their first film. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where it's so yeah. It's done so poorly, it's like, oh, really? The flashing lights on and off. That's supposed to be scary. I get you. Now you got the scene of the clock over and over and over again. Okay, I understand. But those, right. It's so shticky, it makes me laugh because it's so schlocky, I guess, whatever word you want to use. What about that when it comes to kids and scary movies and so forth?
Well, I think a lot of kids enjoy scary movies to an extent. Obviously, very, very young children, probably not so much. They kind of get spooked sort of easily, so you want to make sure that that's age appropriate. But horror movies, I think for some people, is the way that roller coasters are for other people. It's kind of like they feel like it's a type of thrill, and they enjoy that. And so I think, again, that's all about your parenting philosophy as well, in terms of what you want to allow your kid to consume and if you want them to do it in your presence or not. I would say that for younger children, though, stick to the age, the age-appropriate movies that are scary, because otherwise it's you who's going to pay, because they won't go to sleep and they'll be in your room and they'll be bothering you all night, telling you that they can't go to sleep because there's monsters behind their bed or something like that.
Has there ever been any research to indicate that films can lead a child one way or the other?
Lead a child one way or another? What do you
mean
by that?
Well, in other words, like open them to the power of suggestion. I got somebody texting me about The Omen and movies like this and those kind of things.
Sure. Yeah, or like Ouija board. Do you remember
that? Yeah, right. They're Ouija boards.
When we were younger.
Right.
Yeah. And then you know, you all of a sudden feel like now you're somehow conjuring, you know, negative spirits or even the devil. Yeah, I mean, I think that children and adolescents in general, because their brains are not as well developed, they are more open to the power of suggestion as well. Peer influence, it's all the same things that we've been talking about in the past conversations as well. And so, again, I think that this is where some parental education and monitoring is very helpful, and also just kind of a dose of reality and what is actually true. But also knowing that despite your best efforts, they may still misinterpret something, go down a path, you know, power of suggestion, thinking that this is real, thinking that maybe they want to take up witchcraft. I mean, all of this can potentially happen, and they're more vulnerable at the ages that they are as minors.
I know when I was a kid, we found an embalmed hand and we would hold it and it would talk to us. Oh, wait, that was a movie I saw. When it comes to allowing kids to make their own decisions about food, somebody texted in. How do you handle that? Because you want the kids to, I know moms that feed their kids a steady diet of chicken fingers and French fries because it's easy and the kid will eat it. It's not the best thing in the world. We see the research. It shows that as parents expose their kids to peanuts, you're not supposed to give infants peanuts. Let me clean this up. but that it can decrease peanut allergies, but you do want to have a well-balanced diet. So I guess the question is, how do you get kids to eat what they're supposed to eat without making them sick? And then for the parents that just decide to go the quick, easy route, the danger's there.
Yeah, I think that it's easy, of course, to sometimes just say, well, at least my kids will eat this, so let's go ahead and do that. But I really try, and again, this is obviously every day is different, but I try to take an approach with my child where basically they have to eat some healthy foods first before they can have a treat. So you can't have the treat before dinner. You know, you have to wait for your treat. And if you didn't have enough healthy food, you don't get a treat that day either. Even on special occasions, right? So again, on Halloween, someone's birthday, it's like, okay, well, you can have the birthday cake if you have enough of, you know, this chicken first, you know, a couple of bites of the broccoli. But it's not so much about volume, right? Because you just want to expose your kid to healthy foods and just let them know that that's an option. So I feel like when parents are like, oh, they have to eat the whole bowl of peas, it's like, well, they're probably not going to eat the whole bowl of peas, but could you say eat some peas or eat 10 peas? Something that feels a little bit more realistic to them, but at the very least, you've had the exposure. And I think that there is some research that just exposure to vary their palate really helps later on, because as adults, they will end up making choices that are more varied, and inevitably that will include some healthy foods. But you don't want to give them a complex, right? You don't want to be like, you can't ever have that food. That's bad for you. I try really hard not to tell Luca that that food is bad. I tell him the food is the treat, because I don't want him to get a complex about good and bad foods. And that obviously, you know, could lead to some other types of problems.
Oh, later. I'd hate to be a mom and be a neuropsychologist all at the same time. The balance you must try to strike. 9:39, somebody texted in, said 4 years seems like just yesterday Doc was having a baby. And that's exactly right. Time does fly. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back. We'll move on to teenagers and helping them in the decision-making process. And also, I got an email about somebody from somebody who has an adult child that is facing a big life's decision, and they feel hurt that the child didn't ask them for any advice, that they want to do it on their own, and the kid's married. So it seems like, well, that's not really their worries. But we'll see what Dr. Judy Ho thinks when we come back. 9:40, 20 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:47, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our friend Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. I'll take these questions in chronological order, since I got one about teenagers, then I got one about adult and parents and control. This one comes in from a dad whose daughter has had trouble dating, found a date for the homecoming dance. She's spending time with this young man, apparently, and the dad doesn't think much of him at all. Thoughts?
Oh, yeah. That's the worst when you're dealing with teenage dating.
When a licensed clinical licensed clinical neuropsychologist says, ugh, you know you got troubles. Go ahead.
Yep. I know. I mean, I don't envy that at all. I have a son. You know, I think hopefully that'll go a little easier in his teenage years. But yeah, you know, it's so hard, right? Because there's that whole thing where if you start to protest too much, then they like all of a sudden want to be with this person even more, when maybe naturally they might not have lasted as long. So I feel like if your daughter's intending to spend more time with this young gentleman, then you have to try your best to essentially have a little bit more connection, maybe even just to get to know this young man and his family. Just so you kind of know what you're dealing with. It's not so much having a fully open mind. I know that that's going to be hard. At least just open yourself up to having more conversations with him to kind of figure out what he's about. And from there, take your next step. I think it's too hard to just tell your daughter, I don't like it when you spend time with this person, without even having gotten to know this person in any way. Because then your daughter will be like, well, what's that based on? So you actually don't really have a basis unless you at least put that first old college try in.
I'm no clinical neuropsychologist, but I can tell this person this. If you want to drive your daughter toward him, start trashing him. Tell her she can't see him anymore. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. I like your advice a lot of the time, Tommy.
Yeah,
you know
it's
what
true.
Is that?
I'm a real world kind of guy. So let's get to this one. Somebody emailed and said that they have an adult child, 30 years old, thinking about changing jobs. The kid's married, apparently, and the parent here is upset because the child didn't bring them into the conversation about job changes, this, that, the other thing. Again, my real world thing is that's between the grown-up child and the spouse and the parents. Unless the parent is brought into it and asked, that's not really – do they have any say in this? Tell me what you think, Dr. Judy.
Yeah, I mean, it can be hard. I think some of it is about your own feelings that you're not brought in. And your 30-year-old is still your child, right? They're going to be your child forever. So you're kind of maybe feeling left out. Like, how could you make these important decisions without us? But that is the thankless part of the parent job, right? Is that you raise them to be adults who no longer need you in many ways.
Right.
And that hurts. And also when they do partner up, when they do marry, they kind of have their new nuclear family now, and that also hurts, but they're going to consult their spouse before they consult you probably. And so if you do have hurt feelings, go ahead and talk to your son about it and say, I wish you came to talk to us first. They may not even realize that that's something that you wanted, you know? So sometimes I think people have hurt feelings and they don't talk about it. They don't realize that the other person didn't mean to hurt them that way. They're just like, well, I'm 30. I didn't think that you wanted me to come bug you about this kind of thing, you know, or they're just like, oh, I didn't realize that you wanted to be consulted. I'll do that from now on with big decisions if that means something to you, you know, but I think that it's worth either having a conversation, but also having a bit of a reality check. Like, this is not anything that's bad. This is kind of expected at this developmental level.
If anything, I think you could maybe take some credit or some solace in the fact that you raised a kid that's independent, right?
Exactly. You've reached your goal too well, probably, you know?
They don't need you anymore.
That's
exactly
the point.
Well, yeah. let's keep things real. As long as you got assets, they'll need you. Thank you, Dr. Judy. I appreciate
nice
your time as always.
You
bet. Have a nice Halloween.
See you later.
You bet. Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Yeah, as long as you got assets, the kids will keep calling, believe me. You want to get the kids to stop calling, start asking them for money. We'll take a break, come back, find out what Newell's got planned today on WWL.
ARC Raiders, a multiplayer extraction adventure video game set in a lethal yet vibrant future Earth. Play as a raider, where you will settle into a fractured underground settlement, hoping to build a new home and legacy for yourself. In order to thrive, you must return to the surface, where lethal ARC machines roam unchecked and the motives of other raiders are dangerously unclear. But if you are fearless enough, who knows what you might find? Pre-order now for PlayStation 5, Xbox Series XS, and PC. Available on October 30, rated T for Teen.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, I'm Josh Radner, and I am so excited to tell you about How We Made Your Mother, a rewatch podcast looking back at How I Met Your Mother. And I'm here with Craig Thomas, who co-created the show along with Carter Bays. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Josh. Somehow it has been 20 years since the show premiered. I'm going to check the math on that. 10 years since it went off the air, and we thought that made this a perfect time to look back, see what the hell we did, and why the show still seems to resonate with fans around the world today.
Follow and listen to How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.